Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 30th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call and our discussion about objectors and class action litigation. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very happy to have two experts on our call today. We'll hear first from the Honorable Gerald Wolpin. He's the former Inspector General at the Corporation for National and Community Service and a former Chief of Prosecutions in the Office of the United States Attorney in the Southern District of New York. He'll begin with opening remarks about 8 to 10 to 12 minutes discussing a case, and then we'll get some reactions and comments from Professor Jonathan R. Macy. He is the Sam Harris Professor of Corporate Law, Corporate Finance, and Securities Law at the Yale Law School. As I mentioned, we'll get about 8 to 10 minutes or so from Mr. Wolpin, and then turn to Mr. Macy, Professor Macy, rather. With that, Mr. Wolpin, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Dean, and as usual, hats off to the Federal Society for doing these. Let me explain why I did what I did in this case, which was called Gordon against Verizon. I understood that the fairness of our litigation system essentially rests on two factors: the attention of a judge, and most importantly, the adversarial system, which ensures that each party's claims and demands are questioned by the other party. Unfortunately, the adversarial system does not exist in most settlements of class and derivative actions. And in too many settlements of these actions, the merits of the settlement do not receive any serious attention from the trial judge. Let me explain why this is the reality of most such settlements. A corporation announces to its shareholders a corporate acquisition or sale of assets, using that example. It retains lawyers and financial experts who advise the corporation of all material facts that should be disclosed in the proxy statement, which is provided to shareholders. But once announced, the reality is, and this is the fact, in about 97 or 98% of such transactions, a lawsuit will be brought promptly attacking the transaction as paying too much for what is being purchased or accepting too little for what is being sold. And the plaintiff will also allege that material facts had not been disclosed. So how does a lawsuit like this get commenced so quickly when the proxy statement was just put out and it's a complicated event? And after all, it is only a shareholder in that company who can be a plaintiff. But this is the reality. There are plaintiff lawyers who have an inventory of people who own a relatively few shares in a large number of different companies and who have enlisted with that lawyer to serve as a plaintiff if the lawyer decides to bring the case. And what is in it for these plaintiffs? When the lawyer gets his fees out of it, he pays that plaintiff an amount on which they have agreed. Now, once the complaint is filed, the plaintiff lawyer is interested in settling it as quickly as possible, as long as he gets a meaningful fee. And the corporation's lawyer has the same objective. He, too, wants to settle the case, he or she, to settle the case as soon as possible so as to be able to consummate the purchase or sale for two reasons. First, as long as the case remains open, a danger exists of the need to delay consummation of the transaction. And second, as long as the lawsuit continues, the corporation will hemorrhage money in the form of its legal fees and time and attention of corporate management. So essentially, the corporation says it might as well pay to plaintiff's counsel what it would have to spend, and usually less than what it would have to spend, on defending the lawsuit, and thus quickly end the lawsuit. and to settle, they agree on a meaningless additional disclosure, and most important, on a figure that plaintiff's attorney will seek as attorney's fees, and as to which the corporation agrees not to object. It goes to the judge, who unfortunately, as to most judges, says to himself, the parties have agreed, it will take another case off my calendar, so why should I question it? Thus, the adversarial system is non-existent, and the judge pays little attention to the merits. That leads me to discuss this specific case in which I got involved, Gordon v. Verizon, in the New York Supreme Court. I, probably like most of you, repeatedly received notices of settlement of class actions in which I'm a member of the shareholder class. Generally, I frown at it, and after giving it a quick perusal, I simply throw it away. There's nothing worthwhile for me to do. But when I received this notice in the settlement of the Verizon class action, I frankly thought it was such pure larceny for the plaintiff's attorney to seek $2 million for doing nothing, and in the settlement, obtaining for the shareholders, meaning including me, nothing worthwhile. I thus invoked my right, of which I had been advised in the notice, to file as an objector. I pointed out that the purported supplementary disclosures made by Verizon as part of the settlement were immaterial, and that the supposed change in governing rules also agreed to as part of the settlement effectively did not affect any change whatsoever, and most importantly, were irrelevant to the circumstances of this transaction. Thus, everything was pure window dressing. Fortunately, the judge we had, Justice Schweitzer, was a very able and conscientious judge. He held a hearing at which he allowed me to speak for 40 minutes and another objector for 30 minutes. The end result, Justice Schweitzer denied approval to the settlement and rejected any attorney's fees for the plaintiff's attorney. In his opinion, Justice Schweitzer based his decision on many of the grounds I have already discussed here, and which I put in my objection. Thus, Judge Schweitzer explained that this, and I quote from his decision, this body of law meant to protect shareholder interests from the absence of due care by the corporation's managers has been turned on its head to diminish shareholder value by imposing additional gratuitous costs, meaning attorney's fees, as an example, on the corporation. Unquote. And he referred to the absence of the adversarial system from this type of case by quoting with approval a Seventh Circuit decision that recognized, and I quote, the incentive of class counsel in complicity with the defendant's counsel to sell out the class to recommend that the judge approve a settlement involving a meager recovery for the class but generous compensation for the lawyers, the deal that promotes the self-interest of both class counsel and the defendant. Unquote. Obviously, that comment applied in spades in my Verizon case, where not even a meager recovery was provided to class members. Members got zilch. So that's what I decided. That's the short, concise statement of why I did this and the result. I'm happy to answer any other questions after I hear from the good Professor Macy. Go ahead, John.
Thanks, Jerry. That was a very compelling and succinct description, both of your case and this class action process in general. I have one modification to what you said, and just in the sense that my own view of what often happens in these cases is slightly different than yours, and then kind of a question about defense tactics, plaintiff's lawyers' tactics going forward. So the first is, I agree with your description completely. There are, to use kind of economist jargon, agency problems, conflict of interest problems on both the part of the plaintiff's lawyers who cares about getting fees and isn't really interested in partaking the class, and also on the part of the judge and maybe even the defense. On the other hand, in order to generate the legal fees you were describing, and in order to generate billable hours on the defense side, if you'll permit me to be extremely cynical, it's often necessary, I think, not to do what you were describing, Jerry, in terms of settling, you know, really, really as quickly as possible, but rather you have to kind of grind out a little bit of discovery and develop something of a record to show, you know, that there's some kind of justification for the bill. So there's a little bit of a kind of a kabuki play aspect to some of this sometimes, which means things get dragged on, which does not at all undermine or supplant your original point. In fact, I think it makes it stronger in the sense that it suggests that the kind of waste of resources in these cases may not be quite as trivial as it might be if these, you know, cases kind of moved more immediately to settlement. The second point that I wanted to raise with respect to tactics after this is, of course, when one is suing a U.S. public company in these cases, the plaintiffs have a pretty wide degree of discretion, you know, with respect to where they can file the lawsuit. And an old article I wrote years ago with my colleague at the time from the University of Chicago, Jeff Miller, you know, plaintiffs are following the model that you described in your remarks, Jerry. Plaintiffs are likely to file cases in jurisdictions where their appeals or their requests for legal fees will not be as readily questioned, and where the judge takes a generous view of what legal fees might be. And I guess my bottom line is I would be kind of more heartened by this case, and I'm very heartened by the case, but I would be even more heartened and more encouraged if somehow there could be this case would have some sort of kind of multi-jurisdictional appeal, and that we wouldn't just see maybe what I would predict might happen, which would be that there may be more filings in other jurisdictions such as Delaware, which are notoriously, in my view anyway, sympathetic to pleas for legal fees. Even in the case it generates the kind of non-substantive result for the client class that we saw in the Verizon case. And I would just add, for example, if one looks at the opinion in the kind of iconic Caremark case by William Allen, one sees that, you know, the settlement in that case, which Judge Allen then Chancellor Allen applauds, was a purely cosmetic settlement, not significantly different than the one that you are so rightfully attacking in the Verizon case. So I guess my view is this is terrific, but I don't think we've seen, I could be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong, I'm not sure we've really seen, a change in, having interveners such as yourself is necessarily going to end this kind of lamentable era in the history of American litigation, this sort of collusive lawsuit that you so rightfully and successfully opposed in the Verizon case. So that's my comment, Dean, and along with Jerry, I'd be happy to address any questions or follow-ups.
Very good. I'm going to go back to Jerry Wolpin, but before I do that, let me open the floor to questions so people can begin to queue up. As always, we're going to take audience questions here, so in a moment we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you can indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Thank you.
So once again, if you have a question, you need to indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a couple questions here, but let me go back to Mr. Wolpin and see if you have anything by way of response or if you want to augment your opening remarks before we go to audience questions. And I should have announced at the outset, Professor Macy's joining us from a train today, so there might be some background noise. Jonathan, I'm gonna mute your phone for right now, but
okay.
I'll come back to you when we have a question on the floor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Shall I go
Mr.
ahead?
Wolpin. Yeah, go right ahead, Mr. Wolpin.
As usual, Professor Macy really sees the top points and has hit on them. There is no doubt that billable hours are important to a plaintiff of a class action. But I think the Verizon case exemplifies the fallacy in that and the charade involved in it. What happened in the Verizon case is that the plaintiff's counsel quickly hired an expert, and the expert spent a little time, very little really, in getting out a report just essentially analyzing the proxy statement. And then plaintiff's counsel, without doing anything else other than drafting a complaint, which is probably a stereotype, brought the lawsuit. And it was only after the lawsuit was begun that the first thing that plaintiff's counsel and defendant's counsel did was to sit down and decide on the settlement. And after the settlement, in order to provide window dressing, plaintiff's counsel took the depositions of two Verizon people. But the settlement had already been agreed to, so it's obviously that was pure window dressing. And what was most amazing in the fee application made by plaintiff's counsel, it's showed, in order to show how much work was done and how difficult this was, supposedly, it asserted that $126,496 had been expended on expert fees. And the affidavit submitted by plaintiff's counsel represented that figure came from the firm's books and records in which all disbursements are recorded. Now, I didn't have any information. I just had a very questioning eye. So I asked that all the documents be produced concerning that expert fee. And lo and behold, in less than 48 hours, plaintiff's counsel, through their managing partner, submitted an affidavit saying that the amount was a clerical error, and that the amount was actually $25,299. Now, you can have your own conclusion as to how such a clerical error could be reached, but it indicates the type of wallpapering that is done and that most judges and in most cases shareholders will not question. Now, it is very true what Professor Macy said, that most jurisdictions and most judges take the view that as long as the plaintiff and defendant are agreeing, why should I bother? I note that even in the Delaware Chancery Court, one of the vice chancellors recently said, and I quote, if you continue to have suit after suit where there is no material change in the economic terms of deals, and simply some additional disclosures, it will really be a drag on investors' returns, unquote. I think that's an indication maybe some people are looking a little more at the reality. As to why plaintiff's counsel brought this case in New York Supreme Court, I think, unfortunately, very few judges in New York State Supreme Court are as good as Judge Schweitzer, and willing to take the time and bother to look into these things. New York State Supreme Court, unfortunately does not have the reputation of a large amount of judges who will do that. If they had brought it in New York, in the federal court in New York, I think it would have been different, and they didn't bring it. Now, one other thing, I do think legislation is needed, but I am no optimist that our legislatures, whether it be state or federal, who are contributed to too often by the plaintiff's bar, will ever pass legislation to insist that an objective person be appointed in every settlement where there is no substantial amount going to the class to opine to the court and take the position on whether or not it should be approved. I think that I could go on, but I think that pretty much comments on Professor Macy's excellent points.
Terrific. Let me unmute Professor Macy's telephone at this point. We do have three questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, if you have a question for one of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's go to our first caller of the day.
Yes, it's David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California. Thank you, Professor Macy and Mr. Alpin, for your comments. I think you probably struck a resonant chord with a lot of the listeners. Myself, I've been recipient of many of those mailings that you have about being advised of being a participant in a class action. I've also been general counsel of companies that have been on the receiving end of many of these types of suits, in almost all cases frivolous in nature. So I have a couple questions, and one I think that the last speaker alluded to, and that is that the objection process is very time-consuming. It's fact and circumstance dependent, and it's all on case by case. And there's a sort of disproportionate value to cost for a small investor to participate that way. So my question has to do with, well, what kind of systemic solutions are at the problem? And there are common law doctrines, chambertry, and maybe it's time to look at those, perhaps the Professional Bar Association, the ethics rules, or even changes to the charter documents of companies, which establish a somewhat different process for resolving these types of claims. But although I do applaud you for going and appearing and objecting, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on a more general solution to this.
Well, I will tell you that although it did not motivate me, I learned after I had filed my objection that an objector can be reimbursed by for his legal fees, and of course, where it's pro bono, by the assumed value of the legal time spent. But I didn't do it for that reason, and I did not. And I still would not have done it even if I couldn't get that. And I don't know that I'll get it. But it's a long time until the case ends totally, because you asked those systemic solutions. So let me, I do think that legislation requiring the appointment of an independent person to protect the unrepresented class, or the class that's not represented by a conflict-free lawyer, is the best solution of all. I'm not an estates lawyer, but my understanding is that a lawyer will be appointed for example, a child in connection with legal fees requested by the guardian. Why can't we have the same thing on class actions? I will add, telling you what's happened since this decision and what motions I've made since the decision, which also tangentially answer your question. I found out after Justice Schweitzer had issued his decision in about December 17th or thereabouts, that as of December 31st, he was no longer a justice of the Supreme Court, because he had been appointed, which is something unique in New York State, as a court of claims judge sitting in the Supreme Court. And while Supreme Court justices, when they reach 70, and that's what happened with Justice Schweitzer, can be reappointed for three successive two-year terms. That is not true of Court of Claim judges. So at that point, the Court of Claim, Justice Schweitzer, no longer could be assigned the case unless, when he took the role of referee, which he would take, both parties consented, or all parties consented. So when plaintiff's counsel was asked whether you consent, he said no, and therefore, shows how much he thinks of his case, and therefore, a new judge will be assigned to this case. In the interim, the plaintiff's counsel moved for re-argument and renewal of his motion for attorney's fees and approval of the settlement, which is now going to go to a new judge, and who knows what will happen depending on who the judge is. But what I did was to make a motion for sanctions against plaintiff's counsel, because it's obvious that under the rules for renewal and re-argument, there was nothing new that he had added, and that he is merely seeking to get a second bite of the apple against another judge. So we'll see what happens with that when the new judge is appointed.
Very good. I'm going to unmute Professor Macy and see if he has anything on this point. Professor Macy?
Yeah, well, I'm chomping at the bit now to ask two questions, Jerry. That what you've said is so incredibly interesting. The first is, do you think that this reallocation, if you will, of the trial judge to the Court of Claims had anything to do with his decision in the Verizon case, or was it purely happenstance? I'm not a big believer in coincidence. I'd be extremely interested in your view on that. That's my first question.
Well, I am not a psychiatrist, but I have great respect, and I had before then, before even the motion, because I had heard from many practitioners in state court, that Justice Schweitzer was really an able, honest, courageous judge. So based on that, I don't think the fact that he was no longer going to be a judge and had to worry about being elected again affected his decision. I think he was just...
It was his decision to go on the Court of Claims.
Pardon me?
It was his decision to go on the Court of Claims.
I didn't explain myself well enough. In New York State, state Supreme Court justices are elected from each county.
Right.
But
the
New York law also provides that the governor can appoint a certain number of Court of Claims judges, and those Court of Claims judges can be assigned by the governor to sit in the Supreme Court.
Got
it. And be the equivalent of a state Supreme Court justice. And so when Schweitzer was appointed as a Court of Claims judge, he was assigned to sit in the state Supreme Court.
Got it. Okay, my second question, if you have, it relates to your description of the Verizon case itself, and I was fascinated and kind of stunned, frankly, to learn that depositions in the case were taken after the settlement number had been agreed to, which is very unusual, I think, to say the least. And I was wondering, did that come out only as a result of your objection, or is that something the parties had disclosed? That just seems like an incredibly interesting fact with respect to this litigation.
The reality, as I understand it, is that in most cases that result in nothing being paid to shareholders, that is the sequence of discovery. And it was disclosed because of the fact that they proclaimed the greatness of the work they had done by listing when they had settlement discussions, when a tentative settlement had been reached, when discovery was had, et cetera. But my understanding is, unfortunately, that is what is the usual sequence and chronology.
Right.
It's hard for me to
fathom the purpose of a deposition if the deposition is given after the case is settled.
Oh yes, you fathomed it, because it becomes the wallpaper that's necessary in order to show that the plaintiff's counsel has done work.
Wow, you know, I thought I was cynical on this. Apparently, I wasn't cynical enough. That's really really disturbing. Thank you. Wow.
We've got two questions pending. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we'll have enough time to get to other questions. Let's take another call.
Hello. So my name is Sean Griffith. I'm a law professor at Fordham Law School, and I was the expert in the other objection in the Verizon case. So as
right.
Jerry pointed out, there were two objectors. One was John Crist that I worked for, and then there was Jerry, and I had the pleasure of appearing alongside Jerry in the Verizon hearing. And
may I interrupt you for 1 second, because I realize I was less than in the time period I had, I was less than full in stating that yes, Professor Griffith was an excellent expert produced by the other objector, and that had a great impact on the judge.
Thanks,
sorry,
Jerry.
I had to interrupt you.
No worries. I just have two comments. One is to respond to something John said, and then the other one is to respond to something that the first caller asked. So John had mentioned the migration of these kinds of cases to other jurisdictions, and then potentially the migration into Delaware, and Delaware being a particularly problematic place with regard to the provision of fees for nonsense settlements. And I wanted to highlight a dynamic that's sort of in process that might address that issue. And one, and it's the what the Delaware legislature is likely to do with the fee-shifting bylaws. So another issue that's related to this is the possibility that corporations can adopt a bylaw to shift the fees of intra-corporate litigation onto shareholder plaintiffs, and more specifically, plaintiffs' attorneys. So the Delaware Bar Council was tasked by the legislature with going back and deciding what to do about this, and the council has just recently come back, like 2 weeks ago, with a proposal not to allow fee shifting. So that's consistent with Professor Macy's interest group theory. But an interesting side note is that they're not going to allow fee shifting, but they are going to allow forum selection clauses. So putting those two things together, what that means is no fee shifting, but that all this, every company, and you know, you could do an ex post forum selection bylaw. So if you get sued in Arizona state court and you don't like it, you can adopt a fee shifting bylaw to move that litigation to Delaware. The likely result is that all this litigation moves to Delaware. And one question I'd be interested to hear what John thinks about this is whether that will change the incentives of Delaware judges to potentially get more serious about this problem, since they're no longer worried about losing the franchise to other states. So that's comment number one. Comment number two is response to the caller whose question was, well, what can we do about this? And, you know, Jerry pointed out that it's possible to recover fees for objections. The trouble with that, of course, is that the fees that you can recover are probably not as much as the bribe that the plaintiff's lawyers are willing to pay to get you to sell out your objection. So the problem is that anytime that there is an attorney who is incentivized to bring an objection for pecuniary reasons, that attorney is susceptible to being paid off by the plaintiff's attorney to drop the objection. And there's anecdotal evidence to suggest that that happens all the time. One person that doesn't do that is Ted Frank. So we should mention the Center for Class Action Fairness, which is a not-for-profit that brings these objections all the time. And I'm just going to put my own plug in. I'm starting a clinic up at Fordham Law School where I teach, where what we're going to do is bring these objections to – I'm going to have 20 students starting in the fall, and what we're going to do is bring these objections to merger litigation all the time.
Gee, I got to – John, do you want to go first?
I think we just lost Professor Macy, so hopefully he'll dial back in.
Yeah.
So why don't
Okay, well, I'll try and fill the void. I don't claim I can fill the void of missing Professor Macy. Professor Griffith, you are certainly 100%.
Hi, it's Macy joining in.
Oh, do you want to comment first? Go ahead. I haven't.
Well, I didn't. Sorry to interrupt you, Jerry. I wanted to thank both of you. I mean, Sean, your comment, particularly tying this into the fee shifting issue is really terrific. But putting something both of you said together with respect to the compensation for intervenors, it is surprising, I guess I would say, that there we haven't seen kind of a cottage industry of intervenors pop up because certainly if you can get compensated even at modest rates, but even the fact that there's also these other sources of compensation from the parties themselves does suggest that there's a kind of an entrepreneurial or market opportunity here. The second point I wanted to make just related to Sean's point about Delaware's kind of rejection of fee shifting and embrace of forum selection provisions in bylaws, and I think these are both of these are very consistent with this sort of idea that that lawyers in Delaware and bringing lawsuits in Delaware is a cottage industry supporting various interests, including special interest groups, and I think that this will be to the extent that these provisions become embedded, that is no fee shifting, but yes to forum selection clauses, then what I think that things will not, that I don't view this as sort of good news from the standpoint of moving things in the direction that Jerry was trying to push things in the Verizon litigation, because I do think that Delaware does allow for certainty for litigants, but that certainty comes at a price of pretty high legal fees and generous legal fees for plaintiffs. So it's a happy environment there for lawyers, but not necessarily for shareholders. That will not change, in my view, unless another jurisdiction comes and sort of ups the ante in the jurisdictional competition for corporate charters, such that firms say, well, I want to be incorporated in another jurisdiction, which will be more amenable to shareholders' interest in the context of vexatious and frivolous and non-meritorious litigation. So that's sort of my view, Sean, but thank you for an excellent intervention.
Sean, may I ask you, was there any suggestion in the legislature or to the Bar Association in Delaware that the fee shifting opportunity occur only where there is nothing material being provided directly to the shareholder class members and the merits of the complaint were very thin at the best?
Yeah, so interesting question. I had a panel at Fordham earlier this week, or maybe it was end of last week on Thursday, which there's going to be a link for it on my website for the video download if you want to watch it. I had three guys from the corporate counsel, including the outgoing chair, Norm Monheit, and two other members commenting on the fee-shifting decision process. And, it's a little bit like the Masons. You can't get a straight answer or whatever happens behind closed doors from them. But it was fairly clear that they weren't considering solutions to the problem of shareholder litigation. They were considering what to do about fee-shifting. So it was very much a binary one or zero choice. Mm-hmm. And I know for a fact that they had in front of them other proposals. So I, for example, have a proposal for solving this problem and sent it to every member on the council. None of that was cited in the literature. I should also say they came out with a legislative proposal and then an explanation for the legislative proposal. Now, fee shifting, as many of the people on the call and especially John would know, has a long, well-cited law and economics literature about the effects of fee shifting on settlement, on filings, on litigation. And none of that literature was cited in the explanation for why they chose to not allow fee shifting. So there are aspects that make it look very much like the backroom compromise that Professor Macy was suggesting.
I do want to add one thing to the comment made, I believe, by Sean, that fees really will be so small that it may not have the impact that one would hope. The fact is that if it was fee shifting, it should go to the shareholder's lawyer as well. And by shareholder's lawyer, I'm talking about the corporation's lawyer as well as the objector. And when you add in the corporation's lawyer, it certainly would be a large amount and would cause some hesitation to any plaintiff's counsel. I have to say that I respect very much the plaintiff's, the defendant Verizon's lawyers in the Gordon against Verizon case. Wachtell Lipton is a firm that I not only respect, I have a lot of friends there, and they were doing what the corporation wanted them to do, which is basically not fight and get rid of the case, get rid of Wachtell's deservingly high hourly rate, and get rid of the time and energy expenditure of Verizon's management. But that results in, of course, nobody being adversarial.
We've got another question pending, so let's take another call.
Hi, this is Lester Brickman of the Cardozo Law School. I have two tidbits to offer and then a question to pose to the panelists. Approximately 20 years ago, I met with Sam Butler, who was then the managing partner at Cravath, and I was talking with him about an early offer proposal, possible application in the securities class action area, and he told me that when Cravath did an M&A, they always allocated some, and I don't remember the number exactly, a half a percent or some specific number, to pay off the lawyers that would contest the merger, and that was standard operating procedure. The second point I wanted to make, I don't know the citation for this, but there was a case, and if somebody wanted to pursue it, they could find it, in which a merger was attacked in a state court, and the matter was actually litigated, and the company stood its ground, and there was no change whatsoever in the way the merger was to take place in terms of how much would be paid and so on. But the judge allowed the plaintiff's counsel a fee because he gave assurance to the shareholders that the M&A was equitable by contesting it and showing by losing that it was equitable. And therefore, the fee was justified. I'm not making this up. But here's the question. I wanted to perhaps address securities class actions in a larger context. Because corporate assets are depleted to pay settlements in securities class actions, gains realized by shareholders at the time of the failure to provide the material information are at the expense of current shareholders. So, as engineered by class action lawyers, one group of shareholders is being compelled to essentially pay another group of shareholders. Now, many investors, and I assume all of us are pretty much are investors, are diversified. Over time, we're both present and previous owners of stocks of various corporations. That means that the net aggregate effect of most shareholder class actions is to transfer money from shareholders in the aggregate, their left pockets to their right pockets, less a 20 or 25% handling charge payable to lawyers. Now, it's also the case that wrongdoers, to the extent that there are wrongdoers, that is people who make the material, who provide the material misinformation or the ones that specifically fail to provide the material information, are virtually never sanctioned in a securities class action. So it's hard to see how there's any deterrence value. So isn't the whole concept of securities class actions a scam against investors? Who wants to take that first?
Jerry, I can unmute Professor Macy's phone.
If he wants to take it first, otherwise I'll speak either way, whichever.
Go ahead, Jerry, and I'll follow you.
Okay. I appreciate very much your point, which is certainly correct as a matter of fact, but it is a practicality of class actions that I don't see avoiding if you're going to have class actions. And I do feel, even though I think that there are too many of the class actions that are merely an annuity for plaintiffs' lawyers and giving nothing to shareholders, I do think that there is a place for class actions. When there is something seriously fraudulent or wrongs committed by management of a company, there is a reason why a class action should be brought. I don't know how you solve the equitable issue of the fact that shareholders who are now shareholders are paying for the fault of the prior shareholders' responsibility. It just can't be done as a practical matter. And the facade or fiction that it is just a liability of the corporation, which is now represented by newer shareholders, but still the liability of the corporation for what it did wrong. And I have to say about your first example, which I would love, if you could find the citation, I'd love to get it because I don't know how I would research it. It just proves how much certain judges believe they have to protect their fellow fraternity members of the bar.
Thank you. You know, Lester, I like both of your points very much. I do want to address your second question about the sort of wealth transfer from prior shareholders and from new shareholders to prior shareholders. If one takes the view, as I think many do on this call, that securities class action litigation is often non-meritorious and frivolous, then of course your point is absolutely correct. But if one were to, pardon the expression, you know, drink the Kool-Aid and embrace the view, even hypothetically, that these lawsuits are meritorious and are righting clear wrongs, then the argument in favor of the securities class action, notwithstanding the wealth transfer, is that it makes everybody better off because it's lowering fraud and therefore increasing the value of securities, because securities are more valuable if the companies that are issuing securities don't engage in fraud or engage in less fraud, in which case, your point is, since we all hold diversified portfolios and we're on the receiving end of the settlement payments and some the giving end, if we embrace the notion that these settlements are meritorious, then there's a kind of a pie increasing economic justification for them. But you know, I think your basic point is very strong. The one second point I wanted to make quickly, if I could, relates to the question that Jerry posed about what the standard would be in a fee shifting environment. I think it's important to remember that under current Delaware practice rules, attorney's fees are not permitted to class action plaintiffs or derivative plaintiffs unless the court determines that a, quote, substantial benefit, end quote, has been conferred upon the corporation. And the problem, of course, is that the Delaware courts have taken an extremely expansive, almost kind of science fiction view of what constitutes a conferring a substantial benefit on the corporation, such that, you know, in the context, say, of the Verizon litigation, it would not at all be unusual for a corporation to make a kind of cosmetic change in disclosure and pay no money whatsoever to the plaintiff's shareholder class and still have it be determined that a substantial benefit was conferred on the company. And that's a real problem. And I think the reasons that were embedded in Lester's hypothetical about the judge who approved the payment to the lawyers in spite of no benefit, and Jerry's point about, you know, the judges are, you know, are lawyers too, and think about the interest in the legal profession, that this is an extremely difficult problem to surmount.
Does anybody believe that securities class actions do deter corporate wrongdoing?
That's a very good question. That's the same question. Do criminal charges deter somebody who's going to commit a crime? And I guess there is very difficult to prove one way or the other, but our society and our system certainly does take the deterrence impact of litigation, whether it be civil or criminal. And
Jerry, I would...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I would put it quite differently, which is, I don't think the analogy is to whether criminal laws deter crime. I think the analogy would be, would a civil suit brought after a criminal action has been brought, do those deter crimes, right? Because, you know, if you look at these cases, whether they be Enron or Arthur Andersen or, you know, many of these cases, you have either a government civil action or a government criminal action, and these lawsuits kind of piggyback or trail those. Now, this is not the case with your suit and with these, you know, cases that routinely follow mergers and acquisitions. But with respect to those cases, I don't think they are meritorious. I think that there are plenty of market checks, and I think it's, you know, extremely rare to see a class action securities fraud suit, you know, that is meritorious. I won't say the set is zero, but, you know, there are a lot of these, no recovery cases that I think statistically probably dominate the set of securities class action suits, in the M&A context especially.
Well, I'm glad we finally reached some disagreement. It's good for any program.
There you go.
I do believe that there is an importance of deterrence in both civil and criminal. But I believe there is also one other benefit that you can't measure, and that is where a class action results in something meaningful going to a shareholder, all shareholders, it can create an aura of the belief that there is protection of shareholders and that our system provides for some watchdog capacity to prevent shareholders from being misused and mistreated by the corporate executive.
I think that's absolutely fair enough, but then the question becomes, in how many cases do we see what you just described, which is some payment going to the shareholders? I don't think it happens very often.
Sorry. I agree with you.
I would say it doesn't happen a lot, yeah.
No, I agree with you, but that's why I think it's important that the procedure and system be allowed to continue, but with the protections which prevent these plaintiff lawyers, as this one, this firm, it had been in 10 lawsuits of the same type without a penny going to shareholders, but they had gotten, I think it was over $6 million in those 10 lawsuits in a 2-year period. Now,
that is amazing.
That can only create cynicism in shareholders. So I think that it's up to the legislature and the judges to ensure that the system be maintained in an integrity way.
Yes.
And bombard those plaintiffs' lawyers out of this litigation by imposing legal fees on them.
I think so many people, including myself to some extent, have become so cynical about the process that it really harms any meritorious claim that might be brought, because the notion is, well, all of these claims are frivolous and they're not worth paying attention to. And to the extent that there is a, you know, a meritorious claim, you do have some kind of fraud or conflict of interest in an M&A transaction or something of that nature. You know, there's a danger that those are going to be ignored due to the, you know, due to the just the this kind of large, they're just going to be lost in the large number of these less meritorious suits.
Mm-hmm. We do have one question pending, gentlemen. Can we take? Can we get to this final caller?
Sure, go ahead.
Let's do that.
Oh, actually, Dean, I'm sorry. That question, when I got disconnected, I just dialed in and hit to be put in the
okay.
queue. So that was
I think we might have one more yet. Let's see if I can unmute this person's microphone.
Hi, Sean Griffith again. I hate to intervene twice. It's so embarrassing. But I have two super quick comments, one on Lester's point about the securities class actions. It's even worse than he makes it out to be because Lester cites the pocket-shifting explanation where it's just future shareholders paying past shareholders or whatever it is. It's even worse than that, though, because directors and officers' liability insurance pays for the settlement of those class actions, and so the D&O insurer...
Right.
Which is paid for by a premium, paid for by the corporation, paid for by all shareholders, is actually the one funding those settlements. Now, you might still think that there's deterrence in securities class actions if you believe that the D&O insurer in underwriting or in the claims process actually does something to instill the deterrence function back into that process. And so I studied that along with the co-author, Tom Baker. And we find that the D&O insurers do actually try to risk rate their insurance to misconduct variables at various corporations, but we speculate that probably that does not reinstill the deterrence function because the marginal difference between a high payer and a low payer on the same amount of insurance coverage is going to be very small and probably not enough to incentivize good conduct. So it's very unlikely that securities class actions serve a deterrence function. The second thing on Macy's point, John's point about the corporate benefit doctrine, that is exactly right. So just to plug another one of my research projects, I have this paper called Correcting Corporate Benefit where I say this is exactly what Delaware needs to do. And, you know, it looks at the origins of the corporate benefit doctrine and says they actually go wrong after this famous Tandy Crafts case where they misapply a derivative suit doctrine into the class action context, and it leads to these M&A cases that Jerry was describing.
Interesting.
Any further comment from Jerry Walpin or Jonathan Macy?
No, I thank Professor Griffith very much for joining in this, and
also Lester Brigman. Thank both of you. Yeah. And our interlocutor from California. This has been really interesting and educational for me. Thank you, Jerry, also.
Well, and I thank Dean for putting this together.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Of course. We're happy to do it. Let me thank you both on behalf of the Federal Society and all our listeners for joining in as well. A reminder to our listeners that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Wednesday at 1 p.m. Then we'll be looking with a Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform, looking at two of the patent cases that are going to be argued in the court tomorrow. But our call is Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.